number two. Last month, on Friday, July 17, White House news reporters readied themselves for an announcement. The United States had decided to lift its brief embargo on delivery of F-16 jet fighter bombers to the country which calls itself Israel. Reporters were tipped off that a formal presidential announcement could be expected shortly. The F-16 embargo had been imposed less than 6 weeks earlier in the wake of Israel's destruction of Iraq's nuclear reactor. The embargo had been so brief as to have no real effect on Israel. But as I detailed last month in Audio Letter 66, it was not intended to have any real meaning. Like every other American protest against Israel in the past 33 years, the brief F-16 embargo was only for public consumption. It was a cosmetic move, purely for the sake of appearances. By July 17, the fickle mind of the American public had moved on to other things, just as it always does. And so, the F-16s were about to be released to Israel. The expected announcement never came that day. Instead, there was a new shock from the Middle East. The Israeli Air Force launched all-out bombing raids on civilian targets throughout southern Lebanon. The big bridge over the Litani River was attacked, causing heavy damage and killing many people. The oil pipeline from Saudi Arabia, which all of Lebanon depended upon for gasoline and other fuels, was attacked and blown up. As reported by the BBC, but not on American television, Israeli jets bombed every single major town throughout southern Lebanon. And Beirut, poor Beirut, wave after wave of Israeli warplanes thundered over that city, which used to be the peaceful pearl of the Middle East. American-made jets with Star of David insignia rained a holocaust of devastation on heavily populated civilian communities. The pilots, many with United States and Israeli dual citizenship, were practicing genocide on the defenseless Lebanese civilians. As the smoke cleared and the moans of anguish faded away, the dimensions of Lebanon's agony horrified the world. In that one raid, some 300 Lebanese were killed, 800 more injured, and thousands left homeless. Over a two-week period, some 450 died in southern Lebanon. During that same period, six Israelis were killed in alleged PLO raids. The White House, which today is a divided house, behaved as if it had been caught off base. Then the embargo on jets to Israel was extended again. The United States pretended to be upset, and Israel pretended to be hurt. Meanwhile, there were words of alarm from an unaccustomed direction. Voices who are normally raised in support of Israel were beginning to say, in effect, "What's going on here?" An example was an article in the New York Times for July 23, 1981. It described, quote, "widespread distress among American Jews over the increased fighting in the Middle East, including the Israeli bombing of Beirut," unquote. According to the article, one influential Jewish leader condemned the raid as, quote, "utterly without redeeming social or strategic value and an absolute violation of community standards," unquote. Another reportedly worried that actions like these represent a danger to Jews themselves. Others appear bewildered, not sure what to think. One rabbi reportedly summed it up in the words, quote, "I still don't think we have all the facts about why Israel did what it did," unquote. My friends, those words are not far from the truth. The fact is that most Americans, including most American Jews, are not being given the facts. The fact is that today, an interlocked military junta is controlling the military actions of both the United States and Israel. America's military policies today are not in the best interests of most Americans. In exactly the same way, Israel's military policies are not in the best interests of most Jews. More than six decades ago, a galaxy of prominent patriotic American Jews tried to prevent the creation of a Zionist state in Palestine. The Zionist plan to set up a new nation to be named Israel was, in their view, a cruel and tragic hoax. For one thing, in those days, Zionism as a political movement encompass fewer than 5% of American Jews. And yet, the small Zionist minority were claiming to speak for all Jews. Beyond that, the anti-Zionist Jews declared that the promises of the Zionists were not only false promises, but prescriptions for tragedy. Israel said the Zionists would be the national home for the Jews, a place of ingathering, of safety, and of rest. In reply, the anti-Zionist Jews showed that the so-called nation of Israel could never live up to Zionist claims. They showed that the nation to be named Israel could never serve as home to more than a small minority of the Jews of the world. And they predicted that the only real accomplishment of Zionist Israel would be never-ending conflict, ever-expanding bloodshed, and tragedy after tragedy. In Audio Letter 49, 2 years ago, I called attention to the prophetic warnings of the anti-Zionist American Jews. Today, two generations later, very few Americans, Jew or otherwise, are even aware of those warnings. But it is those warnings, not the rosy promises of the Zionists, which are coming true before our eyes. As a place of ingathering for the Jews, the nation which calls itself Israel has been a hopeless failure. Today, 33 years after its founding, the entire population of Jews in Israel remains less than that of New York City alone. From 1969 to 1979, it's reported that more than 500,000 Jews have left Israel for the United States, and today over 2,500 a month are leaving for the United States. In a nation of only a few million, that is a hemorrhage of catastrophic proportions. And where are all the Zionist promises of a national home where Jews can live in tranquil security? During the past 33 years, has any other nation on earth been in conflict with its neighbors more consistently and constantly than Israel? Despite these and other facts, the Zionist image of Israel is the one which has been successfully planted in many minds. Even in major media news reports these days, it is often acknowledged that the Israeli lobby in Washington is a formidable force. Today, that power is built upon several foundations. There are four major groupings in the United States which can always be counted upon to support Israel in any situation. One group, of course, are the outright Zionists in America. They always echo the Israeli line, be it right or wrong. Then there are the political conservatives. Even when they may be privately irritated by specific Israeli actions, they remain supportive. They believe that come what may, Israel is America's bastion against Russia in the Middle East. An American Jewish businessman known for his support of Israel, Mr. Meyer Berger, expressed it this way on the ABC television news program Nightline for July 22, quote, "We believe that Israel is an inevitable partner of the United States. It's America's unsinkable carrier in the Middle East," unquote. The third group, a very large group, is that of the fundamentalist Christians. They have been persuaded that this is the real Israel, the reborn Israel of the Bible. This impression is one which has been fostered deliberately by the Zionists from the very beginning. The Khazar roots of modern Israel, which I detailed in Audio Letter 50, are generally unknown to many fundamentalist Christians. Finally, there are politicians in important swing states. Wherever there is a rough balance between Democrats and Republicans, they tend to cancel each other out. That leaves the Zionist minority with the power to swing votes either way. Through money and political organization, they make sure that the politicians who win elections are beholden to them. These four major groups form the acknowledged support for Israel: the Zionists, the conservatives, the fundamentalist Christians, and beholden politicians. But there is one other group, and it is the most important group of all. That group consists of what the professionals refer to as the little Jews, the small minority of self-proclaimed big Jews, that is, the active Zionist leadership here, work on the emotions of all the rest. They do their best to keep all Jews scared and therefore herded together defensively. The so-called big Jews talk incessantly about the Holocaust, making sure that fears and doubts never die. By means of emotionalism, the small Zionist minority have been able to persuade most Jews that Israel is somehow their cause. It is the Jews of America themselves who most of all are the unwitting victims of Zionism. It is they who are becoming uneasy as they watch Israel throwing off all restraints in warfare. And, my friends, it is they, the broad mass of Jews in America, who will soon begin to suffer for the actions of the Zionists. In Audio Letter 50, I discussed in detail the relationship between the two political forces known as Zionism and Bolshevism. Both were forged into living entities in the crucible of World War I. Both have common roots, which claim to be Jewish but are not. And today, both of these political forces use the community of all Jews as a cover for their own activities. The Bolsheviks, with headquarters now in America, work hand in glove with their Zionist brothers who control Israel. Their joint goal is absolute domination of the entire world. Topic number one, I discussed the deadly competition now underway here in the United States between the Bolsheviks and the Rockefeller cartel. Against all odds, the Rockefeller group is succeeding in regaining total control in many economic areas. And the economic power which I discussed in topic number one is intended to translate quickly into political power. If the Rockefeller interests have their way, America is on the road to fascism. Their pattern for America is that of Hitler's Germany. That is their alternative, which they are now pitting against the drive toward Marxist dictatorship here by the Bolsheviks. In my very first audio letter report of June 1975, I described how Adolf Hitler was brought to power in Germany. It was done through the power of giant industries, secretly controlled by the Rockefeller Combine. The governmental structure set up by Hitler was fascism, in which big industry was a privileged partner of government. Today, the corporate socialists are working feverishly to repeat that pattern, only more so right here in the United States. This time, they intend for their corporate empire to be so powerful as to be beyond control by the government, and through their own agents within government, they plan to have their own way against the Bolsheviks. Already the so-called Reagan administration is beginning to show its fascist colors in domestic affairs. Antitrust laws have effectively been shelved. Instead, the United States Attorney General has given a clear green light for all-out corporate mergers and acquisitions. Meanwhile, the administration is rapidly building the walls to contain us all within the prison which America is to become. Under the guise of immigration control, more and more detention centers are opening up. Likewise, the issue of prison overcrowding has been made into an overnight excuse for an enormous prison-building program. When the time comes, they will all be ready for their intended use as concentration camps. The Rockefeller corporate socialists here are looking forward to rounding up and silencing their opposition. In doing that, they believe they will ultimately be helped by the Bolsheviks and Zionists themselves. The Rockefellers have always made a practice of studying the psychological profiles of their enemies. And in studying the Bolshevik-Zionist mentality, they have found an Achilles heel, a fatal weakness. That weakness, my friends, lies in the exercise of power itself. Whenever they have a free rein, the Bolsheviks and Zionists always go too far. Many years ago, one of these people confided to a very close friend of mine, quote, "We're becoming extremely powerful, so powerful that it is a danger to us. The more power we acquire, the closer we come to the surface. We have left a trail. And as we come closer to the surface, the danger is that someday someone will start following that trail. And yet, we cannot stop. We will continue to gather more power, coming ever closer to the surface until we destroy ourselves with our power, unquote. The Rockefeller Group believe that it is starting to happen now. In Israel, the Zionists are casting off all restraints in warfare, creating revulsion worldwide in the process. And here in America, the Bolsheviks are riding higher and higher. On all sides, the self-proclaimed big Jews are beginning to flaunt their power instead of using it surreptitiously. In the news media, in entertainment, in education, in government, on all sides, it is beginning to happen. In all positions of power here in America, Jews are becoming conspicuous by their numbers. Up to now, this is still a phenomenon which millions of Americans are telling themselves they do not see. We never hesitate to count up the other ethnic groups we see in powerful positions, be they Japanese Americans, Chicanos, blacks, or whatever. But many Americans are made to feel vaguely anti-Semitic if they dare to count up Jews in the same way. Millions of others do see it, but talk about it only in their parlors or country clubs. But among the Jews themselves, a few muffled alarms are beginning to sound here and there. A few are beginning to sense the danger of an anti-Jew backlash from the mushrooming visibility of Jews in powerful places. For example, the late Washington Star of May 28 published an article by a top official of the American Jewish Congress. Its title was, "Uneasy Eye on the Anti-Semitic Fringe." As one basis of his worry, he pointed out that Jews, quote, hold public office in numbers disproportionate to their percentage in the population, unquote. My friends, what it comes down to is this. The Bolshevik Zionist elements here in America have acquired so much power that they are starting to go too far. They are beginning to surface in spite of themselves, and the Rockefeller cartel intends to use this mistake to destroy them. The present administration will be forced to turn increasingly fascist on the domestic front, and as the echoes of Adolf Hitler grow louder and louder, there will be a rebirth of what used to be called the Jewish question. It all brings back memories of a day in Detroit in 1943, my friends. I was in charge of sending and receiving cryptographic messages to the late Colonel Charles King, a protege of General Hap Arnold. One day, a family of Jewish friends of mine invited me to their home. It was a Jewish holiday, and I was to share their holiday dinner with them. They were a family of refugees from Germany, and I was fascinated to hear about their experiences. Finally, I asked, "Why did the German government go after the Jews?" The man looked at me and then looked down at his plate as he answered. There was pain in his voice as he said quietly, "I was only a little Jew in business. I was a good Jew. Lots of us were. But it was the big Jews who got us in all this trouble. They just went too far." "What do you mean, they went too far?" I asked. And he said, "They had taken over all the reins of power in Germany. There was nothing they did not control. So now, the good apples have to suffer with the bad." Then he added, "You know, it is several years now since I came to America. In all that time, you are the first person who ever asked me why the German government went after the Jews. So, now you know why." Topic number 3. A few days ago, on August 17, reporters were called together for an announcement by Secretary of State Alexander Haig. He announced that the United States was lifting its embargo on all war planes for that country called Israel. It was a green light for 14 F-16s and 2 F-15s to be sent to Israel without further delay. It was only 1 month to the day after the Israeli bombing of Beirut. Lebanon is still reeling from that disaster. In percentage terms, 300 dead in tiny Lebanon is equivalent to 24,000 dead in the United States. Had a disaster claimed that many lives here in a short month ago, it would still be the only thing that mattered to countless Americans. But it happened in Lebanon, not America. And so it created hardly a ripple when the United States told Israel, in effect, here are some more planes, so you can do it again. In releasing the war planes, the United States did not even express an opinion about whether Israel's use of the planes is proper. In answer to a reporter's question, Haig said that the causes of the embargo had been adequately resolved. But those empty words can never raise the dead in Lebanon nor silence the sobs of those who mourn for them. The release of the war planes to Israel this month is just a continuation of the pattern I discussed last month. The interlocked military juntas of the United States and Israel are in a hurry. They have a hammerlock on military affairs, and they are using it to the hilt. They are pressing forward toward their goal of thermonuclear war between the United States and Russia as fast as they can. If they can't succeed soon enough, they will cut short the stratagems of the Rockefeller cartel, which I described in Topics 1 and 2. Events themselves are showing how great is the rush to prepare for war. On August 17, the American war planes were released to Israel. The very next day, late on August 18, United States time, American war planes were making new headlines. A pair of Libyan Su-22 jets were lured into a brief dogfight with American F-14s. The Su-22s are primarily ground support aircraft. They are no match for air superiority fighters like the F-14. The dogfight was over almost as soon as it began. Both Libyan jets were shot down, crashing into the sea in the Gulf of Sidra. The United States has trumpeted loudly about the success of this air combat. Supposedly, it is to tell the world that we mean business. But in many capitals from Europe to the Persian Gulf, the message is being read in other ways. In Europe, many leaders are nervously saying that Uncle Sam is behaving like a trigger-happy cowboy. And six oil-exporting nations of the Persian Gulf are saying that this proves America has no intention of dealing fairly with the Arabs. By shooting down Libyan jets in an artificial confrontation, the United States is also shooting down any new peace prospects for the Middle East. Beyond that, my friends, the Libyan dogfight episode was also staged for more obscure purposes of military deception. Right now, stories about the Libyan dogfight are being constantly rehashed to keep our attention on the Mediterranean. Meanwhile, the real action is taking place elsewhere. Even the stories you have heard about the dogfight itself are part of a gigantic naval shell game. The pilots who shot down the Libyan jets are not the ones identified publicly by the Pentagon. And, my friends, the planes which shot down the Libyan jets did not come from the USS Nimitz. While all eyes are on the Mediterranean, the real naval action is taking place to the north and west. On July 14, the largest Allied naval war game since World War II got underway. These exercises involve 13 nations, 120,000 troops, 250 ships, and more than 1,000 aircraft. This tremendous exercise, called Ocean Venture 81, is to continue until the end of October. It will include air assaults, anti-submarine warfare, bombing raids, even mock battles between aircraft carrier battle groups. Most important of all, many of these war games will intrude into areas traditionally considered to be in Russia's sphere of operation. These massive exercises, my friends, will include not only the North Atlantic, but the Baltic and Norwegian seas. The naval war games now underway in the Atlantic are built around America's new belligerent strategy against Russia. That strategy was spelled out in an interview by the Chicago Sun-Times 2 months ago on Sunday, June 21. The person interviewed was the Secretary of the Navy, John Lehman, Jr. Lehman spelled out America's increasing dependence upon aircraft carriers. To make use of those carriers, the article describes the Lehman naval strategy as, quote, an offensive one, unquote. Lehman says that our Navy should be able and ready to bottle up the Russian Navy in such places as, quote, the Sea of Japan, Barents Sea, and other coastal waters, unquote. Lehman also gives prominent attention to, quoting the article again, protecting NATO's northern flank in the Norwegian Sea, unquote. My friends, those are the areas into which the massive Allied exercises are scheduled to intrude. It is a radical departure from past American naval policy. In the words of John Paul Jones, it is deliberately sailing in harm's way, quote unquote. This is exactly the belligerent new American naval policy which I first made public in Audio Letter 65 2 months ago. My friends, the Bolsheviks here are working faster and faster on more and more fronts to prepare for war. 2 weeks ago, it was announced that America would start assembling its neutron bombs. That announcement is far behind the reality because they have been in production secretly for many months. The only real purpose of the neutron bomb announcement was political. It's just another way for the administration to show off the chip on its shoulder. Like shooting down a pair of Libyan jets, it's a way of saying we are ready and eager for war. Most Americans would disagree if we were told the truth. But we are not told the truth, and so we continue down the path to war. Now the way is being paved to bring back the draft. Draft registration is already in effect, and now it is being given teeth by publicizing federal prosecution of those who do not register. Beyond that, the government is dusting off the old Bolshevik gimmick of posting public sign-up notices. The idea is to create resentment among those who have registered against those who have not. The net result? Get neighbors to spy on neighbors. Meanwhile, we are being told that the manpower problem is the worst one facing the military. At the same time, we are seeing falsified public opinion polls which say that more and more Americans now favor the draft. Under a declaration of a national emergency, it will soon return. It remains to be seen who will win the hidden struggle between the Rockefeller cartel and the Bolsheviks here. Only one thing is clear. Regardless of which one wins, my friends, you and I lose. Now it's time for my last-minute summary. In this audio letter, I've tried to alert you to the hidden power struggle for control of the United States. On one side are the corporate socialists of the Rockefeller cartel, the fascists. They are trying to gather power away from the government by economic means. Then, using that power, they intend to use the old Jewish question, so-called, to throw a political knockout punch at their Bolshevik rivals. On the other side, the state socialist Bolsheviks are using their control of America's military as their key weapon. They have already declared war against Russia, and now they are trying to drag America into that war, a thermonuclear war. They are trying to do it too fast to be stopped by the maneuverings of the Rockefeller cartel. Caught in the middle is a double-minded Reagan administration. The White House is a house divided against itself, first pulled this way, then that way, by the conflicting forces behind closed doors. Neither the fascists nor the Bolsheviks in our country can save you. Only you can save yourself with the help of our Lord Jesus Christ. He taught us long ago that a house divided against itself cannot stand. The collapse, when it comes, will be awesome indeed. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.